This is the FS Podcast. The FS Podcast is your go-to place for all things financial services. Sponsored by Exadel, we keep you up to date on what's going on in the industry with interviews featuring leading experts, introductions to up-and-coming technologies, and discussions on the emerging trends from around the globe. Today, we're joined by Trevor Ward. Trevor is the co-founder and CEO of Multisig Media. He's also a LinkedIn superstar who talks about all things crypto, blockchain, and metaverse. So for anyone who doesn't follow him, he's definitely someone to check out. Hi, Trevor.
Hello. Can you come on? If we do a podcast ever, can you come do our intro? Because that was amazing.
Thank you. I've been really excited for this one. I definitely know this one's going to be good because I love your LinkedIn posts. They're super informative.
Oh, well, thank you. It's good to know that someone besides just my mom likes my posts. So that's one other one. That's good.
Could you tell us a bit about who you are? You know, what is Multisig Media, which used to be Digitas? I noticed you guys did a name change. You know, the kind of projects you work on, just so we have an understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, I'm Trevor Ward. I jokingly refer to myself as the world's most exotic accountant, mostly just because I've had a somewhat non-traditional career path, where I started my career in public accounting, worked at one of the big four firms in audit. It was absolutely riveting. And yet somehow I found myself leaving that realm. I've also, from there, I went and worked at a global foreign currency brokerage firm. So helped companies move money around the world. I've also been a financial advisor. And yeah, for the last few years, kind of found myself in this niche of like finance marketing, very similar to you. So that's a little bit about me. As far as Multisig goes, so we're decrypting digital assets by connecting Web3 thought leaders with forward-thinking accounting and finance professionals. So basically, what I like to say is, while all the other cool kids are out building NFTs and DAOs and crypto projects, we're silently building the aspects of the industry. So as far as things that we work on, yesterday we just dropped a market map of digital asset accounting and finance software solutions. So we analyzed 50 different companies that are building in the space, and it's fascinating to see, you know, who could be the next SAP or NetSuite of Web3. We also write a bi-weekly Web3 accounting and finance newsletter called Triple Entry that, you know, readers from Wells Fargo and EY, Disney, and the list goes on. There's my shameless plug, but that's a little bit about me and Multisig.
I actually... Well, I guess two doesn't make a trend, but I knew a SEO agency founder who worked at Big Four auditing. So they are definitely the place, right?
That is, to start. You found another unicorn.
That's the thing.
There are very few former Big Four marketing people. You might have to introduce me because he's one of a few.
So before we started recording, we had a really great conversation. So I feel like I want to have that conversation again for everyone else.
Nope,
so you mentioned that the SEC, there was something about the SEC regulations and crypto and something for that banks would want to hear, which are obviously, you know, our audience, people who work at banks. So I'll give you the floor. Maybe you could tell us.
Yeah. So, and the only reason I thought of this is because we actually wrote about it last week in our newsletter. But so basically the whole thing is that banks and traditional financial institutions have been looking at digital assets and kind of sitting on the sidelines, just waiting for regulatory clarity, but obviously wanting to get in the game, right, in some shape or form. So the SEC came out with accounting guidance that actually said that every company, every public company has to treat, if they hold digital assets on behalf of their clients, so if they are a custodian, it's treated as a liability, which for other public companies, they're kind of like, okay, that's fine, whatever, it's an accounting thing. But for banks, it gets really tricky because they're subject to other requirements, capital requirements that say you need to have, for any liabilities on your balance sheet, you need to have a one-to-one cash supply. So now it's like if you hold, billions in digital assets, you need to have the cash. So it's really interesting because I think banks that were gung-ho, ready to jump in, are asking themselves, like, do we really want to do that? So it just is a testament to the shifting regulatory space and some of the challenges that we see for traditional financial institutions.
Can I ask, because I remember with the whole like Basel III FRTB stuff, you had to have a certain, for stress test, you had to have a certain amount of cash based on like how many loans you've given out. Is this, it sounds like you have to have more cash.
Yeah. Right?
So
this is one-to-one. I mean, it's a pretty, so I'm probably going to just completely butcher this quote, but there is a company, Anchorage Digital, and the CEO, and essentially that's what they do, is they help traditional financial institutions onboard to digital assets. Anchorage, if I explain that wrong, I'm sorry. You can come correct me, but the CEO came on and just said, like, this is ridiculous. Like, all of the customers we were working with, like, they just can't meet those capital requirements anymore. So I think the thing that's a challenge, and this is a really, like, we started off deep on some of the challenges here, but it's an ongoing narrative in this space, is where everyone's waiting on the sidelines, waiting for regulatory clarity, and it seems like maybe we got some, but it seems very restrictive. So it's kind of like, well, are you sure about that? Like, because this doesn't really make sense. So anyway, it's part of the ongoing challenge in evaluating whether to adopt digital assets.
What do you think that means for banks? Do you think they should adopt digital assets right now? Do you think they should wait? Do you think the regulations might change? Fingers crossed.
The thing that's tough is I'm not a banker. I, did a brief stint in a very particular niche of financial services, which was foreign currency. So it's tough for me to say. I do think there's a lot of opportunity there for banks, in the sense that, if you just look at the numbers of especially younger generations that are just flocking into digital assets, I think it's important to be able to evolve and adapt. Then again, I don't think digital assets or blockchain technology is going anywhere. So timing is a major consideration, because I do think there are a lot of requirements, and there's a lot of extra work that comes, and even risk that comes from holding digital assets. So I think it's just, you have to weigh out, is the risk or the opportunity, does that outweigh the potential risk?
Yeah, and I mean, I do feel like I don't know if you're going to agree with me, but I do feel like everyone is now acting as if like blockchain and Bitcoin are like 100% here, and this is it now, we're all going to pay for our food with Bitcoin. But like, it is still volatile to some degree. Like, I remember a few months ago, all these experts were like, oh, it's not going to go below 20,000. 1,000,000,000%, it will never, ever, ever go below 20,000. That's the cap. And it just tried to clamber up to 20,000 and then just dropped back down like really recently. So I don't know. And then everyone's just acting like, oh, that didn't happen. That no one said that 20,000 number. So I do feel like, yeah, there is still some, and banks have so much that they, you know, they have so much, like, they have so much infrastructure and they have so many kind of layers already to deal with that I think, for, you know, if it was me, it'd be like, wow, like, this is a big project, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly, if I were a bank, I could see, I don't know that I'd be in a huge rush. One, because it's, I mean, it would probably be an ancillary service anyway, where that's not going to become your main revenue stream, custody, digital assets, or any, like, facilitating that kind of service. But two, because it is just a constantly changing landscape. And I think that you have you have companies that are now providing solutions to help with that. And this is why I get really passionate about helping other accounting and finance professionals understand the space. Because to your point, you have the people that are just like, blockchain's gonna cure cancer and it's gonna, like, we're gonna solve world hunger and stop all the wars. And it's like, no, it's, I mean, it is amazing for a lot of different reasons, but we need to take a practical approach, not just, oh, we're going to the moon, you know, for everything that has to do with crypto, so, or blockchain, or these technologies. So I think we just need to take a very just common sense approach to this new technology.
Yeah, it's like when the NFT burst happened, and like, it's like, yeah, cool way to sell art, that is true. How much is a tweet really worth? Like,
yeah, and I think it's really easy to lose sight of what the technology actually is, or what the innovative technology is that we're talking about. Because I do think there is a place for digital art. You know, I've bought and sold NFTs. I think they're a lot of fun. We could talk all about the cultural revolution that they're causing. I mean, it's the same way that, for the same reason that people have bought fancy art for, you know, millions of dollars, or a Rolex, or a nice sports car, it's a way to flex, basically, right? But I think that is just the very tip of the iceberg for NFTs. The underlying technology is that you can now prove ownership on, for assets that live entirely online. So, I mean, you talk about like a title or a deed to a piece of property or a home, right? Now, right now, it's all kept in some kind of central registrar, like a title company. But if you could put that as an NFT, you could prove, oh, okay, yeah, so Trevor does own that home, as we can see from the blockchain.
So before we started recording, you also mentioned that you have heard people say that DeFi is going to eat up banks, and that you don't think that's the case. What do you think about, like, well, tell us your thoughts, and then if you could tell us how you think financial institutions can leverage DeFi themselves.
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I guess just to start, before I go rambling about on DeFi, I'll explain a little bit of what it is, assuming that not everyone knows, but it stands for decentralized finance. So essentially the premise is that everything that we use traditional financial institutions for, whether it be lending, borrowing, investing, saving, will all be, it's all replaced by code or software online. So it removes the intermediary, it removes the middleman, and it takes more of a peer-to-peer approach. So, and really it's more of like a peer to smart contract approach, meaning that if I wanted to lend, let's say that I have cash sitting around And I'm like, hey, I want to lend this out to someone to gain a yield on that. And you, Deborah, are like, hey, I'm actually looking to borrow some money. We could both go to this DeFi lending protocol and I could lend that money to you. Or I really could, I'm not lending it directly to you. I'm lending it to this smart contract, which is really just a fancy way of saying code that stipulates a transaction. And so I will earn yield and you can borrow that at an interest rate, and it's all done online. So so that's what DeFi is in a nutshell. So there's this idea that, you know, financial institutions are somehow going to be replaced entirely by these, by code and by these DeFi protocols. And I really don't think that's going to happen. The same way that, you know, the internet didn't completely wipe out physical branches of banks, right? I think that if anything, there's opportunities to leverage the technology and actually just create more, just better service for clients, whether they be institutional or retail clients.
So you mentioned a few times, like, ways that financial institutions can leverage these different technologies. Can we start with, let's start with NFTs. How do you think financial institutions can get the most out of NFTs? And then we'll kind of move on to some of the other ones as well.
Oh man, you're putting me on the spot here. This is this isn't something I've thought.
Sorry,
a ton about.
I know we should have warmed up to that a little bit.
No.
Just genuinely interested.
Let's think. I mean, I think a lot of that has yet to be explored in terms of how can they use NFTs. But again, I think the best way to go about it is asking yourself, what is the technology? And it's essentially proving ownership of things that live exclusively online. So, or it could be used for possibly for KYC, right? So there's a lot of ideas, a kind of a newer idea that hasn't really caught on the mainstream, are something called soulbound tokens, meaning that you have an NFT, but rather than being able to trade it, and the whole idea is that it's can move from whatever party, you have NFTs that are treated more like a personal identifier online. So like a social security number or a passport. And so if you can imagine, if you have like your own digital passport, that could make, and you have a digital wallet, that could make KYC instant, because all of a sudden it's like you have all of your information and it's not going and filling it out over and over again every time you want to do business with a new financial institution.
Soulbound tokens was definitely made up by like a millennial who games, right?
Well,
like that's like straight out of Skyrim, right?
Well, and that's I mean, I think you bring up a really good point, right? It's, I actually, and I haven't told a lot of people this, so confession, I actually hate a lot of the names that we use, the, a lot of the terminology that we use in Web3, because it's just, it isn't intuitive at all to, especially to like finance people. It's like, well, what, like, what's an NFT? Like, what is that? Oh, it's a non-fungible token. Okay, what is that? Like, and so I think that part of the struggle is that this is a world that was created by developers, which is great. I thank the developers for doing the job that like I could, like I would never understand or have that skill. But I think the issue is because there isn't like a marketing head or agency that's like, hey, what should we name this? It's just, it really is some developer that's like, you know, I really like NFT. Or like, I like DAO. What, like the Dow Jones? No, like DAO, like Decentralized Autonomous Organization. Wow, that's kind of a mouthful. Well, we'll shorten it. It's a DAO. You know, it's a problem.
You mentioned Web3. Would you be up for telling us a bit about Web3, maybe how it was built, how it functions?
Yeah, so that's another one of those interesting phrases where it's like, wait, what was Web 1 and Web 2, right? But I think it's a phrase that's catching on, and it's definitely not one of the worst of the terms that we throw around. So Web 1, well, I'll start with a little bit of a history, just because I think that helps. So Web 1, you could classify as the time period from 1990 to about 2005. So, and this is like your AOL era of the internet. Netscape, AOL, things like that. So,
MySpace?
MSN? Yeah. No,
MSN,
yeah.
And Bebo?
Yes, yeah.
I was there for that.
AOL Instant Messenger, good stuff. I can't believe I'm admitting this, but my AOL Instant Messenger screen name was Chicks Dig This Dude with an X. It was terrible. It was terrible. And here I am openly admitting it.
I actually often like to pretend that I'm Gen Z. So me admitting that I even know what AOL is really embarrassing for me.
That's also. That's very millennial of you. Yeah, secrets out. So why would you want to pretend you're Gen Z?
They're just so much better than us. They're just like, you know, like, the mustache.
In what ways?
You know, like the mustache and the, what was it, like the jam jar cups. Oh, God. No, TikTok's way better. They smashed,
I don't know.
It. The skinny and jeans. Oh.
Eating Tide Pods? Awesome. All right. Sorry, Gen Z. You're pretty cool. Anyway, Web 1, AOL, Netscape, MSN. It was controlled by the internet community, and it was basically built of open protocols, meaning the rules were open, the rules of the system, like everyone could see it. It was just like this big open, almost like a public park. Web 2 was 2005 to really now. I call this the reign of fame. So all of the big tech companies, and what happened is they started to outgrow some of these open source protocols. So they had to create their own rules for the system, which created these walled gardens. So it was, Web 2 has been really great for a lot of reasons, right? Like we got Google, which allows us to search the web and find any information for free, which is amazing. The whole smartphone revolution is incredible. But what Chris Dixon of A16Z, he's a partner at A16Z, he has a lot of interesting articles around this, but he calls it the bait and switch of Web 2. So it was kind of this idea of like, everyone come on here and like hang out, and it's a great way for you to build an audience. Same with YouTube, like come be a creator. And then once they reach critical mass, it's like, hey, actually we're gonna take the lion's share of the profits. Oh, and I mean, we've seen a lot of the problems that come about from these Web 2 companies, right? Web 3 now, it seeks to solve it. Well, really it takes the best parts of Web 1, meaning it's open source protocol and the people own the internet, and the power of Web 2, of like these powerful applications, and it combines them together. So Packy McCormick, who runs the newsletter Not Boring, he says it's the internet owned by builders and users and orchestrated with tokens. So everything's open source, ownership and control are decentralized. So it's kind of like taking the technological advancements, but then opening them up so they're open source and everyone can have a piece of that.
What about blockchain? So how is a blockchain distributed ledger different from a traditional ledger?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, and I think this is, I'll use an analogy that my fellow finance nerds will love and relate to. It's essentially the difference between using an Excel spreadsheet that you just save on your desktop, on your internal hard drive, versus a Google sheet that multiple people can collaborate on. I would say the key difference, though, is that with a Google sheet, it's great until some Yahoo on your team comes and deletes the whole thing. And it's like, wait a second, who deleted the Google sheet? So the difference with a blockchain ledger is that there's a consensus mechanism, which is a fancy way for saying there's this set of rules for adding or appending to or making any type of change to that ledger. So in order to come and change it, you have to meet these rules. And so really that's the difference with distributed ledgers, is there's a whole bunch that's goes into securing the ledger. Because really ledgers are just, all they do is establish consensus on facts. So it makes sure, it gives security that what is on there is true, that someone didn't come in and just change it.
We're big Google Sheet users in the Exadel content team. So you've just given me like major anxiety. would you say that the blockchain is a trusted approach? And if so, why?
When you say trusted, what do you mean by that? Like trusted by,
consumers? Yeah. Like, so if I was a financial institution saying, you know, we use blockchain for something, is that going to be like a positive marketing message?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because blockchains are often referred to as trustless technology, going back to the whole ledger thing. And I think really this is one of the key value propositions of this technology, right? Is before this point, you had to trust a central intermediary that the ledger is correct, right? So in the case of a bank, really banks keep these very complicated ledgers that say, hey, Trevor deposited money here, but then like we lent it out to this person and they're paying us an interest. Like, it's just really all it is this massive ledger, and we trust the bank to maintain the integrity of that ledger. Where with blockchain, it's, well, you're trusting, the whole idea is that you have a bunch of different people that are validating that ledger. It's interesting when you start talking about trust. As far as from the consumer perspective, do consumers trust blockchain? I wrote this down. Yeah, so my friend Hugh Meyer, go look him up on LinkedIn. He's a great guy. He's a financial advisor. Posted this yesterday. He said, so Bitsamp recently ran a survey of 28,000 respondents across 23 countries. And the US showed the single biggest increase in trust of crypto, from 61% in Q1 to 73% in Q2. And then a 44% increase in retail respondents who said they currently invest in cryptocurrency, from 42% to 61%.
44% currently invest in crypto.
Well, that's a lot. I think keep in mind, this is a survey.
Is it like of his followers?
Well, no. So this is BitSamp's survey of 28,000 people. No, and it was a 44% increase. Interesting. Yeah. So I'll have to go get the official stat. But the whole point is that during the, I mean, Q1 and Q2 of this year, that's when we saw the whole Terra, Celsius, like the meltdown of a major stablecoin.
Yeah.
And like, and yet trust in cryptocurrency is increasing. So
yeah.
I don't know if it's because trust in maybe central banks is decreasing, or I don't know, but I was blown away by that fact, and I should probably go and look at the actual source before but I trust Hugh, and Hugh put it on his LinkedIn, so it must be true.
That is really interesting, actually. That is really interesting. What's your point of view on the lack of FASB involvement for establishing clear rules on how to account for digital assets? That was a bit of a mouthful. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. So the FASB, or the FASB, is the Financial Accounting Standards Board. So they're essentially the rule setter for accounting standards in the US. And it's for years, public companies and institutions that have anything to do with digital assets or thinking about it have begged the FASB, like, please come out with clear accounting guidance on how to account for digital assets. And because it is a huge challenge, in the sense that, so just to give you an idea right now, let's say you were just to do something simple, plain vanilla in the crypto world. Like, I'm going to go buy Bitcoin and hold it on our balance sheet, right? Even if it's just a small portion, we're going to see if it actually is an inflation hedge to balance out some of our cash position. So, and a great example of this is Michael Saylor. He's the founder of MicroStrategy, public company that owns a bunch of Bitcoin. So let's say you bought Bitcoin at 60,000. You were unfortunate to buy it at 60,000. Now we're sitting at around, 20,000, below 20. And so from an accounting perspective, you would have to write down the value of your Bitcoin to 20,000. And that comes as an impairment loss on your actual balance sheet. The trick is that when it goes back up, not financial advice, you cannot subsequently write the value back up. So you will now, until you actually go to sell it. So everyone now has like this discrepancy between, hey, we have all this Bitcoin that's at 20,000. Meanwhile, you have, investors and readers of the financial statements that are where they're saying, hey, like, what about that Bitcoin? And it just isn't an accurate reflection of the assets that you actually hold. So there's a big push. There has been a big push of like, hey, let's just do fair value accounting, similar to how you would with like a derivative, or like a hedging contract. And fortunately, the FASB it's on their agenda. They've defined their scope of what's going to be included in that. So they're doing it. So FASB, keep it going. Keep us accounting and finance nerds happy. But yeah, that's the story with FASB.
On a kind of global scale, do you see any sort of, global revolutions or like super innovative processes happening as a result of the increasing implementation of blockchain technology?
Oh, wow. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, I think I have an interesting perspective having worked in the foreign currency world, where if you look at our current infrastructure for moving money around the world, it's very, I mean, it's like Frankenstein. It's very disjointed, and we've built a lot of things on top to help, kind of like, we have SWIFT and we have like all of these kind of like interbank transfer systems, but we still, like, if I want to send cash to you like right now instantly, it's kind of difficult to do through traditional means, because usually there's a you know, a waiting period of a couple days. There's fees involved with the currency conversion if I'm wanting to convert, you know, USD to pounds. And if I use like a Western Union, for example, they're going to take, you know, by the time, if I want to send you $100, it's like, you know, $90 by the time it gets to you. So I think that's a huge one. That's a huge opportunity, is I think just with Bitcoin alone and some of the things that, like, the Lightning Network, which essentially just makes it faster, we can have this instant settlement network where there's no more, like, I think up until this point we've had, hey, you can send us the goods and we'll pay you. Don't worry, it's just going to take forever for you to actually get the payment. So, like, the transaction settlement has been very separate by a couple days. But now we can put them together and we have instant settlement. So I think that's a big one. I also think there's lots of implications for, like, just emerging countries as well, right? Where people that maybe haven't had access to financial services or even a bank, they can use some of these decentralized finance applications to now have access to financial services. So, I mean, I could go on and on. There's lots of revolutions that are being stirred by the technology.
So my turn for a shameless plug. That's actually exactly one of our clients' ninth year. That's actually exactly what they've built, which is using blockchain to just do, like, almost, I think it is instantaneous FX settlement times.
That's amazing.
Right? That really is cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I was even watching a TED Talk the other day that talked about this small remote village in Africa where they need water and they need to build a well, but they don't have the funds to do so. And so now that, but what they do have is they have, I think it was goats, maybe? They have goats. And so now it's like, but the issue was, if they were to trade a goat, it would, like, they had to walk it all the way into town. And it's like, well, we can't, like, wait a month to get payment for our goat. So now it's like they're using blockchain to have this instant settlement, and now they're building a well in this village. And that's, like, a very hand-wavy, like, feel-good story. But, like, it gives you an idea of, wow, this is an amazing possibility once you bring this to, like, we tend to think about it just from the frame of, like, you know, hey, how can I, like, make this faster and better? Where for, I think, the majority of the world, it's how can we, oh, we can have an account to actually save money without having to go to a bank or without having, and again, I think that's where there's opportunities for traditional financial institutions, is using some of this technology to really just expand their reach.
Yeah, definitely. You've written about the elements of crypto cycles. What are they? And yeah, what are they? How do they benefit, like, consumers?
Like, I'm, like, trying to remember. I'm like, oh man, what did I write? you can see the elements of crypto cycles. We've gone just similar to any other asset class, right? Like you look at like Ray Dalio's done a lot of writing around long-term debt cycles. If you haven't read Changing World Order, what is it? Principles for a Changing World Order, highly recommend it. But yeah, like the same way we have these like 20-year debt cycles, I think it was 20 years, there's cycles in crypto markets where I think we just came off of this massive bull market run where unfortunately there's a lot of leverage in the system that wiped out, you know, 3O's Capital and Celsius and some of these other institutions. But basically it's people get really excited and it's like, we're only going up, stocks, crypto, everything only goes up forever. We're invincible. And it's just like, then people start to look at all these really stupid things like Terra, for example. It's like, oh, well, if I buy this Terra stablecoin and, you know, lock it up in this Anchor DeFi protocol, I can get 20% yield. So that makes logical sense. And then it all, you know, eventually it's like, no, this doesn't make sense. Which I actually really like bear markets, because there's this phrase in Web3 that's just bear markets are for building. And I think what it does is it flushes out all of the grifters and all of the people that are just in it for a cash grab, both from like a retail side, an institutional side, and from a building perspective, because it's like there's no promise of instant fame and success. It's, hey, wait a minute, like, you know, it's probably going to be really hard and we're not going to make a ton of money right away. Like, we're not just making a token to, you know, in replacement of like a GoFundMe. It's I think people are building some really cool tools, which is why, you know, which is why we did that market map, where it's like, wow, there's some companies that are doing treasury management and accounting for digital assets, right? So I like bear markets for this reason. I mean, I won't mind when we come out of it, but it's a fun time for building.
So last question. If someone loved what you had to say, wants to hear more, wants to follow you, how can they find you? How can they find out more?
Well, my personal address is, no, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to give you my personal address. My on LinkedIn, Trevor Ward, CPA. I write a lot on there. Also, our fancy newsletter that we just launched, Triple Entry, that's at multisig.media/triple-entry. So that's another great place. And then, yeah, we do like webinars from time to time, just on different topics, things that we covered today. And yeah, there's a lot more exciting things to come.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This was the FS podcast hosted by Exadel. Don't forget to follow us to hear more.